this moment, I can risk a smile. And so she's going to smile. No. Don't do a smile, just think a smile. And that was the sort of coaching I had. So he had, in fact, to reduce me to something completely different from what he had recruited.
Now what about, I mean, this is one of the most extraordinary concepts for a film. Did you know really what you were signing up to? How did he explain his...
He didn't. We didn't get any explanation. We were just directed. That's not uncommon in the performing world, especially in opera. You don't get much consultation. They don't say, this is what I'm trying to do. They cooperate. They just tell you what to do. And he did pretty much that. But I was fortunate because in the earliest period, I was doing a performance of Parsifal in the Munich Opera, and he lived in Munich, and he invited me to his house on several occasions. And we had, I remember having breakfast with him one day. And then he did start talking about how I perceived Parsifal. And then I said to him, how do you perceive Parsifal? And he said, well, Parsifal is Wagner. And I said, you mean the character Parsifal? He said, no. The opera is Wagner. So what you were talking about at the end there was really pretty much the case. That Ziemerberg at least thought that this was an autobiographical essay. Autobiographical portrait of his own musical and spiritual journey. From being an unsuccessful, no doubt, wounded composer in Paris in competition with Meyerbeer and so on. Through to more successful and producing these huge operas, The Ring and so on, having a tremendously tortuous sex life, and finally arriving at a sort of resolution in the marriage with Cosima, which released perhaps his anima, put him in touch with a different sort of person, and out of that came Tristan and Parsifal. I think that's what he had in mind. Mm. He didn't actually articulate it in quite that way. I've had to do a bit of rationalising myself. But I think that's what he had in mind.
Look, somebody, please, would you like to ask? There must be a lot of people burning to ask more questions.
In the heart.
Yeah. You indicated that seeing Gordemans was rather strange in some way. It was not a typical part. I'd be very interested to hear what you had to say on that. Because in Parsifal, the part of Gordemans, listening to a fine singer with all that legato singing, I find extremely attractive. I go to the Parsifal just to listen to the Gordemans.
Well, good. Yes, I was attracted to the part very early on in my career. A lot of basses are attracted to the part because it hasn't got any high notes in it. I mean, that's absolutely true. If you see the film Magic Flute by Ingmar Bergman, there's a very nice little moment in there which I don't think anybody else will have noticed, but I did. And that's that Sarastro, at the end of the first act, goes back to his dressing room and sits there studying the role of Gunmans. Virtually everybody that sings Sarastro in the world fancies his chances at Gunmans, because it's the same sort of tessitura, the same sort of voice and so on. What they find after about 6 months, 2 years, that they can't actually master it. It's too long, too boring to learn, and Germans serve to go. So they give up. So fortunately, there aren't many people who actually sing Gunemann. There's an awful lot of people learning Gunemann. What makes it difficult is that it's almost a new style of writing, especially the first act is almost entirely a kind of recitative. Musicians get a bit fed up when I call it recitative, because perhaps it's not, but it feels like recitative when you do it. It's narrative, nearly all narrative. And a lot of the music is slightly off the beat. In fact, most of the music is off the beat. But it doesn't sound it to the audience. You'd never guess, if listening to it, that it was awkward. Assuming the singer can cope with it. The reason for that, I think, is that Wagner was treating this narrative in very much the same way as Monteverdi treated the narrative in the very earliest operas, as accompanied recitative. And he was as he wrote it, he was narrating in the way that he would narrate. Debussy does the same in Pleyel's Maison. So that the rests, and it's the rests in Gounod's, which are awkward. You can remember the notes, you can remember the words, but it's the rests between the words which are so difficult to remember. Is this 1.5 beats, or is this 2.5 beats, is it half a beat? And because it moves fairly sort of evenly, you haven't got any kind of rhythmic impulse to help you remember what the rests are. And it's only after a very long time that you come to an awareness that what he's doing is breathing. That he's inventing his breathing and his pauses according to how he would have delivered this text personally. And once you tweak that, it becomes much easier to learn it. But some people go on treating it as an aria, and it doesn't fall into place as an aria at all. It only falls into place as recitative. Does that help?
Do you think that's the reason why the music seems to sort of hover? That those, the way you're talking about the rest, it's as if there's almost like a meditative.
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah, I think he's surrendered to the idea of it being a narrative. He's not trying to write tunes. He's not making us enjoy ourselves. He's delivering the narrative with the help of an orchestra. And therefore it gives it as I say, there's no high notes in it. You're not going, no moments of great excitement. Even the greatest moments of excitement for Gounod are not high notes. The ecstasy he feels when he sees the spear for the first time is not a high note. You rather wish it were, actually. You want another third on the top there so you can really get a grip on it. But it's not. It's simply natural. The only difficult note in it is at the end of just before the Good Friday music, with a big rising praise, ending in an E natural, which is as big as they come. Even that's manageable because any conductor worth his salt will drown you on that note. so bassists don't have to be afraid of even of that note. There's very little real kind of Italian style ecstasy in it.
Just as we were describing the notes and the pauses that were so difficult to, almost as if there's something. I just came into my head that, as if it was sort of hovering.
Hovering.
I mean because of those pauses and the notes not quite meeting each other.
Hovering might not be the word I would use. I think perhaps I would use hesitating. There is a sort of hesitancy in the way Gounod delivers his speeches. And they are also, I always think, a lot of what he says is beautiful. And I think it has to be sung beautifully. And one of the problems that people have always had with Parsifal in the past, I think, is that many of the bassists that sing Gounod are too grumpy. The part. The voices are too rugged. Too Hagen-like,
No, it's very special. And Jill and I are listening together. The top part of your voice, Bob, it is so beautiful. It flows wonderfully. And that's just really lovely. Of course, the score itself probably has more fermata in it than perhaps any other mature Wagner score. It really does. And a conductor like Jourdan, he actually honours that, doesn't he?
Yeah.
You studied the role, actually, with Reggie Goodall.
I did indeed, yes. I spotted it very early on as something I wanted to do, and at that particular time, Reginald Goodall was in the dustbin of history, actually. He had been, in his early days, a very significant conductor. He conducted the first performance of Peter Grimes at Tattles Wells. But he didn't have a developed conducting technique. Orchestras didn't find what he did particularly helpful, despite the fact that he delivered it with such extraordinary feeling, and anybody that had contact with him carried away this tremendous feeling, especially for Wagner and especially for Parsifal. It was absolutely, by a long way, his top favourite opera. And when we studied it together, he would actually weep during Good Friday music. He was playing the piano. you keep going the right hand, you get a dirty right. He was, in that sense, he was totally inspirational. He was a wonderful person. And when I came to do it at the Metropolitan Opera with James Levine, I did a particular phrase in a particular way. He said, did you study this with Reggie? And I said, yes. He said, you can always tell.
Anybody else? Yes? Tom?
No, I was going to say, another question.
Oh, yes? Jill, you wanted to ask about Androgyne, didn't you? You wanted
Before I do that, could I just say, when you talked about the restative effect of, you know, how he works on Parsifal, this is something that Debussy picked up later on, didn't he, for Pelléas et Mélisande. And the part of Golo, I suddenly was thinking, do you think that Golo, the part of Golo, the man who is so riven with jealousy and despair about what he thinks is the love affair between Mélisande and his younger brother, Do you see any connections with Amfortas or anything like that?
Well, yes, certainly. I mean, they, not least because the same people play the roles. You know, you can't help hearing the voices.
Yeah.
Golo, who was also an Amfortas.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, yes, I'm certain Debussy had that sort of thing in mind. Yeah. Actually, the character who's most like Gounamans is Arkel, which is
the character
I play.
Arkel, of course.
And he's
more like
Tichiro.
I always think he's half dead anyway.
Yes. Tichiro's interesting because I did it at Covent Garden 2 years ago in their new production, which nobody liked. You liked it. And it was innovative insofar as Tichiro was on stage. He was wheeled on a wheelchair. And I did find it very creative. Very good thought, because it turned Dutroux into a really, really grumpy old man who had completely rejected Amfortas. Amfortas came and pleaded to him, completely rejected him, pushed him away. And that was an interesting interpretation.
Anybody else?
There are a number of things about this film which are quite amusing. One of the things I find with Wagner, and particularly with Parsifal, that you have your sort of what I call a bullshit Geiger counter on high alert, because there's an awful lot of, I don't know, excuse the word bullshit, but it fits what I mean exactly. I mean, Codswallop. And there was a great deal of Codswallop around during the making of the film. There were a lot of people who hadn't had a clue what was going on. They were just opposites and so on, you know. And also some of the French people that came in, part of the supporting team, they also weren't really interested in it at all. So there was a great deal of Codswallop, and it was difficult to keep abreast of what was valuable and what wasn't. And I was responsible for one example of Codswallop. One of the pictures that you said were on display behind the credits, you know, you mentioned the Caspar David Friedrich. Well, I think the next picture after that is of the woman on horseback.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I told Seward Birch over breakfast one day that there was a William Blake painting of Blind Pity riding horseback. And it is, it's magnificent. I don't know, some of you will know it. This horse with its mane flying, tail out, and Blind Pity, you know, blindfold on the horse. But he got the wrong end of the stick. He blinded the horse. He thought the idea, because Parsifal is about, you know, really, if you want to know what Parsifal is about, the only word you can apply is compassion. Really, that's the word which is picked out, underlined in red, and mentioned. So it's about compassion. It's as though Wagner suddenly discovers compassion as an ingredient in the art that he wanted to make. Or perhaps he noticed that compassion was a bit in short supply in 19th century Germany, it's possible. But anyway, he discovered compassion, perhaps through Schopenhauer, who was big into compassion too. I forgot what I was saying.
About the picture. The picture.
The idea of blind pity seemed terribly relevant. That's why I mentioned it to him. Not that pity is compassion, really. But he liked the idea. He picked it up and he put it in there. Put the blindfold on the horse. So when you see that bit next time,
While filming, were there moments when the whole thing collapsed because people got the giggles? You know, they're having the female Parsifal and so on. I mean, what was the
No, it was all very heavy footing. The whole thing was very, very heavy. Tremendous respect.
It was all this.
Even the technician and so on.
No jokes.
No, there was one French guy who was very cynical. Right? He did like spotting pretension. And he would sometimes come and whisper to me in my ear that this is ridiculously pretentious. And we'd have a bit of a chuckle. But no, it was pretty serious stuff. You know. There was another moment which is quite important for you to know if you're going to take this film really seriously, as you seem to be doing. is that in the I arrived on the 21st day of filming. They filmed all the flower maidens and all that stuff before I got there, and I was the first actual musician to turn up on the set. There had been no musicians of any sort there until then. They had the recording that they had made several months before, and it was an old reel-to-reel recording. And they filmed the flower maidens with this. When I got there, I noticed that what I was practicing, I had to practice my mouthing and so on in front of the television. I realized that what I was mouthing to wasn't at the right pitch. It was something like a semitone or even a tone wrong sometimes. So I asked them to investigate that, what the problem was. And the problem was that the reels were too big. So that as this reel got bigger, it got slower. And as it got slower, the pitch would have been slower. The problem then was that they had done the whole of the flower maidens at the wrong pitch. So when they put it up to the right speed and the right pitch, the flower maidens were mouthing it in the wrong place. It was a very, very serious problem. And in a fact, sort of way, I got the blame for it.
Pointing it out.
Our relationship was never quite the same afterwards. But we cancelled the film for 36 hours or more. We went home and we waited to find out what was going to happen because they hadn't got a budget for getting the flower maidens back. They'd all gone off to Berlin or wherever they lived. It was a disaster. Zuberberg was totally and completely at his wit's end. And then he came up with an idea. You will have noticed, if you've seen the film, that Kundry had a bowl.
Yes.
You know? What do you call it? A saucer of bowls.
A crystal bowl.
That she held in her hand. Well, Zuber had the idea that if he painted that with reflective paint, he could project the flower maiden section that was out of sync onto that. It could all happen inside the bowl, and it wouldn't be big enough for you to be able to see how they were singing. Which is what he did. And it worked. Now, what I don't know, and this is where you really do need to bullshit, don't you? After he made the film, Zuberberg wrote a lot about it. I would love to know what he said about that, because he won't have fessed up to that.
It's not in the bowl.
Robert Lloyd, look, this is absolutely wonderful. Well, thank you very, very much indeed for coming today.